it wasn't, and they went on to experience developmental delay for want of a simple hearing aid. This is happening in a number of different parts of the UK. Have you been affected? We'll talk about those comments from Kemi Badenoch on some cultures having more value than others, but I want to start in the Middle East again, I'm afraid, as Benjamin Netanyahu decides escalation against Hezbollah is the course of action he's going to take. Is the UK government right to urge restraint at this point?
On your radio, on Global Player, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Hezbollah's deputy leaders insisted the group is ready if Israel begins a ground invasion of Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qassem has been speaking after an apparent Israeli airstrike hit Beirut for the first time in the current conflict. Israel hasn't commented but has claimed responsibility for killing Hamas's leader in Lebanon in an overnight operation. The former head of the British Army, Lord Dannett, says Israel could still send in troops.
Whether the Israelis will do that will be their judgment as whether they feel they need to do that, whether they're making enough success in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, with the very successful airstrikes that they've been conducting with some massive weapons. That's a judgment call, which I don't think they've decided on.
Four police officers and a staff member are to face disciplinary proceedings over the David Carrick case. The watchdog's been looking into how the Metropolitan Police dealt with four allegations against the serial rapist while he was a serving officer. He was eventually arrested in October 21 and jailed last February. An 18-year-old is set to go on trial next June after a schoolboy was stabbed to death in southeast London. 15-year-old Dejon Campbell was attacked with a zombie knife in Woolwich earlier this month. Jacob Lozovich was remanded in custody at the Old Bailey. Two other teenagers have now been charged. Two of the Tory leadership candidates will face members' questions at the party conference later. Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch will take to the main stage in Birmingham this afternoon. Yesterday, Rishi Sunak told the conference that the party must stop squabbling if they want to win back voters' trust. Despite that, Scottish Tory MP Andrew Bowie told LBC he thinks the Tories can get back into number 10.
If we get the policies right, if we get our platform right, if we talk to the British people about issues that concern them and they want to see a rest, then I think we can offer a positive, optimistic vision for the future, completely at odds with the doom and gloom being espoused by the current occupants of number 10 and number 11 at Downing Street.
And a bulletproof vest emblazoned with the Union flag by Banksy has been put up for sale. Sotheby's estimates the item will fetch between £200,000 to £300,000 when it goes under the hammer. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 62 points at 82.58. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.19. LBC weather staying wet and windy for much of England and Wales, with the heaviest rain in the north. Brighter elsewhere with highs of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Jenny Barsby.
Sam used to worry about rising energy prices, but not since fixing his tariff. Instead of spending hours looking for deals, he just relaxes in the shower, singing, rather badly. Because with a British Gas fixed tariff, you're protected against future price rises. And if we release a cheaper fixed tariff, you can switch to it, absolutely free. Search British Gas tariffs. Eligibility and T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I want to try and work out together, I suppose, why Benjamin Netanyahu is choosing the course of action that he's choosing in Lebanon and against Hezbollah specifically. The reason being, the chorus of calls for de-escalation and a ceasefire were pretty strong, weren't they? Still are pretty strong from the UN, the US, the UK. Although the US did, if it's the right word I'm about to use, applaud or did certainly welcome, that's a better word, welcome the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of the now late head of Hezbollah. Not so the UK, I don't think. Rather more muted response to that. And as Benjamin Netanyahu decides escalation against Hezbollah is the course that he's taking inside Lebanon, despite those calls for de-escalation, for its very opposite, is it possible that he is right to take the fight to Hezbollah in this way, a group doing Iran's anti-Israel, anti-Western, anti-American, anti-UK, anti-democratic bidding. Because that is what Hezbollah is, in part at least. And we've also got relatively recent history going back to 2006, UN resolutions designed for de-escalation, designed to keep a kind of buffer zone between northern Israel and southern Lebanon. And that clearly isn't working and hasn't been working for some time. Benjamin Netanyahu has made a clear decision that in order for the 60,000 or so Israelis in the north of Israel to go back to their homes, he has to essentially cut off at the knees Hezbollah, who've been firing rockets into Israel since October the 8th of last year. Israel has been doing, as you know, because we've been reporting on it all the time, a number of different fairly striking opposite attacks on Lebanon, some of them on individuals, some of them on large numbers of Hezbollah operatives. But of course, as ever, civilians injured in this as well. So really what I'm trying to get at is whether you think there is any merit in this decision to escalate and to really tackle Hezbollah, or is it more? Is this more about Benjamin Netanyahu making a decision to stay in power, to continue this battle in order to stave off some of the domestic issues that he'll face in the end? This is something that, an accusation that's levelled at him quite frequently. His response to that seems to be: look, you've seen what Hamas will do. They did it on October the 7th. We've been seeing for a year what Hezbollah will do. They've been doing it since October the 8th, and people have had to leave their homes in their tens of thousands from northern Israel. And we're defending ourselves from that. That's what he would say. Enemies on all sides, that kind of message. But interestingly, here's Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, speaking to reporters at the UN about Israel's latest actions.
The Israeli Prime Minister came here today and said that Israel is surrounded by those who want to destroy it, an enemy. We're here, members of a Muslim Arab committee mandated by 57 Arab and Muslim countries. And I can tell you here, very unequivocally, all of us are willing to right now guarantee the security of Israel in the context of Israel ending the occupation and allowing for the emergence of a Palestinian state, independent state, along the reference that we all agree. He is creating that danger because he simply does not want the two-state solution. And if he does not want the two-state solution, can you ask the Israeli officials, what is their end game?
Sam Kiley joins me to talk about this, international journalist of more than 30 years and a former foreign affairs editor at Sky News. Good afternoon to you, Sam. Great to have you on the programme.
Thank you, Sida.
His intervention, Ayman Safadi's intervention there, was an interesting one, isn't it? Because he's talking about two very different groups of Arabs, isn't he, when he says what he says? It's valid what he says, but it leaves out a certain something as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it really does go right to the root of the problem, though. What is Israel's end game is a question I have to answer many times a day at times like this after covering the region for so long. And it's very, very difficult to discern. In the case of Benjamin Netanyahu, I think he's a man of no strategic vision, but he's all about tactical survival. So for him, the process over the last 25, 30 years for Israel has been, let's just get by, let us use military force to ensure our security, rather than take what is an existential gamble, potentially, certainly from the Israeli perspective, with a long-term solution, a two-state solution that, in the view of the Israeli right, and indeed the center and some in the left, could move the front line with these forces that they claim to be surrounded by literally to their doorstep. Now, there are many voices, of course, inside Israel who think that that is nonsense. But that is the long-term strategic vision that the Jordanian foreign minister was calling for there. And I think it's very important that he reminded the world and undermined this notion that it is Israel surrounded by enemies. It does have enemies in Hezbollah. It has not advanced the two-state solution. The Likud party under Benjamin Netanyahu also has a written policy, which in some ways echoes Hamas, in saying that every piece of territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea will be Israeli sovereign territory. Of course, the Hamas slogan is from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Yeah. So they're kind of competing long-term strategic visions there.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, when the Jordanian foreign minister said what he said, my first thought was the Abraham Accords and those Arab nations that were prepared to, out of a huge degree of self-interest as well, because, Israel is a tech and economic superpower. It's got its problems because of the current situation. But I'm guessing that looking to the future, they would like a slice of that knowledge, a slice of that trade. So it's not all... out of selflessness, is it, that they would do this? But the same simply doesn't apply to Iran, Hamas and Hezbollah, does it? And they are surrounded by them.
Yeah, so you've got... let's start with Iran. Iran has had presidents for the last 20 years or so that have said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but more or less, Israel is a cancer that needs to be cut out of the body of the Middle East, the kind of, certainly interpreted in Israel and by critics of Iran, as a genocidal policy. In support of that, they back Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is a state within a state in Lebanon. It can mobilize, it claims, 150,000 people. It sent 40,000 people to fight for Assad. It is also part of an international criminal mafia network of drug smuggling and money laundering. And then down in Gaza, you've got a Sunni organization, which in the form of Hamas, that is also... not clear really whether they really mean the destruction of Israel or the destruction of the concept of the Jewish state, but again, has consistently attacked Israel no matter how much military pressure they've been put on. They're still firing rockets into Israel, and they are also backed by Iran. So in that context, one can see why perhaps Netanyahu's conducting this campaign now against Hezbollah, an organization that it claims has the capability to fire rockets and hit targets deep within Israeli territory.
Well, it is essentially an army within a state, isn't it? It's a non-state army within a state, in part, Hezbollah.
Oh, no question about it. It also has members of parliament it has guaranteed, more or less guaranteed, in terms of the sectarian structure of the constitution in Lebanon, certain number of seats are reserved for certain communities, and the Shia vote often goes to Hezbollah. So they have parliamentarians, they have medical infrastructure, but above all, it is a militant military organization that depends very, very strongly for sources of income and direction from Iran and from drug manufacture and other criminal activities for the rest of its funding.
I mean, sadly, and probably inevitably, civilians are killed in these kinds of actions, even though you could probably differentiate between, I'll let you speak for yourself if you don't want to differentiate between the events in Gaza and the events in Lebanon so far anyway, but civilians inevitably caught up in it.
Well, I think, sorry to interrupt there, but I think there's one very, very stark difference. And we saw this with the unclaimed, but nonetheless clearly obviously Israeli attacks on Hezbollah's communication systems, with the pager bombs and the next day with the walkie-talkies. Now with the very, even though there's over 1,000 dead, 1 million people, according to the Lebanese government, have been displaced. Yeah. The Israelis do seem to be conducting, quote-unquote, or in more targeted operations than they are in Gaza. I think there is a very stark difference indeed. Mm. It's difficult to see when you're seeing such ultra-violence, but the sort of violence, the profligate use of very high explosive bombs to attack militants in Gaza is very much, it was incomparable with the operations
in Lebanon,
Lebanon, which therefore begs the question, why are the Israelis conducting those sorts of, why have the Israelis been conducting such abandoned, operations inside Gaza, with, of course, allegations of the threat of ethnic cleansing and genocide coming from a lot of Israel's critics. In the case of Lebanon, it is very widespread. It is the most violent air campaign I think the Israelis have ever unleashed. Hezbollah is suffering unprecedented levels of casualties. I think the numbers of civilian casualties inside Lebanon are increasing exponentially. They're just in the last 24 hours, the Israelis hit in central Beirut rather than in the Hezbollah stronghold in the south of the capital there. So all of that is mounting up to a humanitarian disaster too.
And on Nasrallah, I mean, inevitably, you know, as we've seen with Yahya Sinwar in Hamas, you know, these individuals become synonymous with the organisation for pretty obvious reasons. You know, they have important leadership roles in them. Nasrallah, I hadn't realised until he was killed, I hadn't realised the depth to which he personally was involved in things like Syria, for example, the siege of Aleppo, and how much Assad had cleaved to Hezbollah for help during that war. I mean, Nasrallah really was responsible for huge numbers of civilian deaths himself, wasn't he, inside Syria?
Well, certainly Hezbollah has been, as one of the most potent fighting forces coming in on the side of the Assad regime at the insistence of Tehran, which, of course, has got forces there and has been backing both the Assad regime and Hezbollah. Very important route, too, for the Iranian military support for Hezbollah comes through Syria. That's why the Israelis have been bombarding the Lebanese-Syrian border. So, they've got a very deep connection. And it's very interesting indeed that there were sort of ambivalent feelings in the anti-Israeli establishment, if you like. So there are people around the world, and particularly in the Middle East, who want to see an end to the sort of Gaza campaign that the Israelis have been prosecuting, seeing the very frustrating behavior of Israel over the last 20 years in consuming the West Bank, where the Palestinians are supposed to eventually establish a state with settlements, wanting to see some kind of quote-unquote payback, and encouraging kind of fanboying Hezbollah for that. And then at the same time, the grotesque role that Hezbollah has played in the Middle East in terms of support of an organism such as the Assad regime. So there's often this sort of conundrum for a lot of people. I can tell you that inside Lebanon, there will be dismay and hatred for at the Israelis, as there often and usually is, but also very deep frustration that once again the Lebanon is being attacked because of the actions of Hezbollah, where again there is sympathy for the support of the Palestinian cause, but no longer a territorial defensive role for Hezbollah in their own country. Of course, that would change if the Israelis, as seems to be threatened, sending ground troops, something I think that Hezbollah would probably welcome on a tactical level.
And Sam, I think it's worth a word before you go on UN Resolution 1701 back into, or as a result of the 2006 war between the two. We're hearing a lot about it, or I've been hearing a lot about it over the weekend. It's worth reminding people, or telling people for the first time, what that is, because Israel's position is, look, well, that clearly didn't work, did it? So we're taking matters into our own hands here. So what is it, and why was it so key?
Well, it came in, you recall that for about, I can't remember the exact dates, for about nearly 20 years, the Israelis were in occupation of South Lebanon until the year 2000. They withdrew, and then Hezbollah occupied that space that they had been in the south, therefore very, very close to the Israeli border. Then they had a war in 2006. It actually went quite badly for both sides, arguably. The Israelis lost, they were surprised by the strength of Hezbollah's resistance. But nonetheless, in the sort of the resolution that came after that, in the quote unquote, and I keep using that term because it's all relatively speaking, but in the reduction in fury of the violence between the two sides, Hezbollah was supposed to withdraw north of the Litani River, which is about 30 kilometers, broadly speaking, north of the border with Israel. They didn't do that. What they did do is hollow out mountains. I've been into some of these. They've actually got a kind of Hezbollah land there where you can go into a hollowed out mountain, and they've got a kind of James Bond maze of artillery positions, hospitals and so on. And they will have repeated that throughout South Lebanon in anticipation of a renewed conflict. So they continue to pose a threat to Israel. Critics of Israel will say, well, the Israelis have continued to pose a threat to Middle Eastern peace because the Netanyahu government has absolutely ruled out a two-state solution. That's not an analytical position with the Palestinians. That's a matter of government policy. So in that context, the region feels partly, in a sense, condemned by both sides to a level of perpetual conflict in and around or with the state of Israel.
Great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Sam Kiley, international journalist of more than 30 years standing, former foreign affairs editor at Sky News, which I'm sure you remember him from as well. Loads of you calling in on this. I'll get to your calls in just a second. It's 1:19.
This is LBC. Right now, in communities across the UK, people like Flo are struggling.
I'm 11 years old. I'm a carer for my mum.
LBC's charity, Global's Make Some Noise, funds vital projects and offers assistance to those who need it most, including those that give young carers support and counselling.
You don't feel like you're alone as much anymore.
You can help change lives across the UK. Donate to Global's Make Some Noise and help people like Flo. Proudly supported by Furniture Village.
You've arrived, your dream holiday. You got there for less thanks to comparing flight prices on Kayak. An idyllic local restaurant nestled in the cliffs. A peaceful pool with your own private sunbed. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare flight prices from hundreds of travel sites and bag a great deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
Hey, it's Bruce the Butterfly. Did you know that Scottish Power are the experts in solar panels? Trust me, as a butterfly, I can spot who's just winging it. And if you're already a Scottish Power customer and choose to go solar today, you can enjoy a £500 credit on your electricity account, which is a pretty sweet deal from where I'm fluttering. To find out why Scottish Power are the one-stop shop for solar, fly over to scottishpower.co.uk. The £500 applies to Scottish Power customers and will be credited to electricity bill. See website for full details.
So, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, I've called you in today because Charlie has been using some rather colourful language, and the dinner ladies don't really appreciate it. The word he used was...
Some conversations aren't worth the trouble. People used to think talking about your finances was one of them. But with a My Money review at Skipton Building Society, you can get advice that helps you make more sense of your money, and it's completely free. That's one less conversation you'll regret later.
I want 50 lines of I will not teach my children bad language.
Online, over the phone or in branch. Search Skipton Building Society to find out more.
This is LBC with Sheila Fogarty. Call 0345 6060973. Alexa, send a comment to LBC. Text 84850.
I know that this situation in the Middle East is fiercely complicated and that we all come at it with partial knowledge, partial experience, with views of our own about how we would respond to certain things if it was happening on our own doorstep. You know, family history will be in the Middle East for many of you as well, or living history, I mean, not just the past. So it is fiercely, fiercely complex, and anyone who says it isn't is fooling themselves and trying to fool you, I would suggest. But I'm trying to get under the skin of why, in the face of a kind of mantra internationally to de-escalate, Netanyahu has made the decision to really go after Hezbollah in a way we haven't seen. I mean, you know, if you're just stepping back at it, looking at it militarily, it's extraordinarily bold. And I'm not saying that in flattering terms or unflattering terms. I'm just saying in sheer military terms, the boldness of it and the intent behind it, it is extraordinary. And I want to get a sense to bring it back, you know, bring it back to our country here, bring it back to what Keir Starmer and David Lammy are saying, which is de-escalate, 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 ceasefire, 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 two-state, two-state, two-state. That's the mantra, isn't it? And it's the mantra from Joe Biden, despite his and Kamala Harris's praise or welcome of the Nasrallah assassination, the Nasrallah killing in that bombing at the weekend. But the reason he's doing it, he says, Netanyahu, that is, he says, is because nothing has stopped the escalation by Iran. Nothing over the years has stopped the escalation of Iran's desire to get rid of Israel and its meddling to that end. Is he right to see it that way? Is that how you would see it if you were living in the north of Israel, if you were living in those kibbutzes in the south, if you had experienced October the 7th in that way? Or from the Lebanese perspective, because not everybody in Lebanon supports Hezbollah by any means. And, you know, many of those innocent people will have died, both in Israel, both in Gaza and in Lebanon now. So why do you think he's making the decision to escalate in the face of that mantra to de-escalate? Why do you think he's doing that? And do you think given what's happened since 2006, given what's happened to that 1701 UN resolution, which has just been completely ignored, essentially, by Hezbollah, to create that buffer between Israel and southern Lebanon, and given what's been happening since October the 8th, you can't underestimate that either. Since October the 8th, Hezbollah saw its opportunity to attack a weakened, deeply traumatized Israel after October the 7th and just start to bombard the north. You know, think of it happening to the UK. What would we expect our government to do? De-escalate and form a state with these people or not? 0345 6060 973. Is Netanyahu right to escalate, or is Starmer and David Lammy, are they right to call for de-escalation? Nick has called from Elstree. Hello, Nick.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, Sheila. Netanyahu is 100% correct in escalating this. It's all very well, everyone, from an outside perspective to say, oh, de-escalate, etc. They didn't have the atrocities committed to them on October the 7th. And you look at how Hezbollah reacted on the 8th. They attacked Israel not because of in support of Hamas. They did it purely because it was an attack on Jews. It was an attack on Israel. They have it fundamentally within their ideology that Israel is the pariah and they want to alleviate Israel. So I am 100% in support of Netanyahu. To reiterate, I do not like innocent civilians being killed. But the other view that I have, which is quite hard, which is quite right-wing, admittedly, is that if you're going to conceal military weaponry and terrorists within civilian areas, whether it be a hospital, whether it be under a residential building, as it was in Nasrallah, then Israel has the right to go in and to exterminate the terrorists. It is a travesty. It is horrific that there are civilian casualties. But these people are not stupid. The terrorists do this because they don't care about their people. If I was the Arab nations other than Iran, I would be turning around and going, how do we get rid of these guys? You know, you had the Abraham Accords, you rightly point out, about how there's agreements with Saudi Arabia, etc., and Qatar, and that's the reason why Hamas embarked on that barbaric event on the 7th, because they wanted to put that off kilter.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear on the radio last week, I think it was last Thursday, a Saudi ambassador, forgive me, I can't remember his name off the top of my head now, but it's a Saudi ambassador speaking, and he was saying, we are ready. He was talking about why they engaged with the Abraham Accords, you know, and obviously there was a degree of self, you know, perfectly legitimate self-interest in it when it comes to trade and wealth and the like. But he was saying, we are ready and willing to help rebuild Gaza. We are ready and willing to engage with Israel in trade, in diplomacy, in all kinds of things. But we are not going to engage if, and I mean, he wasn't as blunt as I'm about to be, but he was clearly saying, we're not going to engage if all we're help rebuild and spend money on rebuilding. If all we're going to see 10 years from now is a repeat of this, we have to get beyond this repeat process. And it seemed to me, listening to him, that, I mean, he was very rational and plausible man.
My phone signal's going.
Got to go. That's a shame. But I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Nick, which is a shame. That's never happened before. Phone's dying. Do charge your phones, ladies and gentlemen, before you call in. But this chap, he's very rational, very reasonable, very knowledgeable, of course, about the area and his own country's interest in the area. But it seemed to me that what he wasn't saying explicitly, but was coming through every space in what he said, was that this has got to be about, if normalization of relationships can occur, there has to be an end to this Iranian, what would you call it? I heard one commentator this weekend calling it regard it like a corporation with Iran at the top of it. Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Iranian operatives, Hezbollah operatives in Yemen, in Syria. You know, that this sort of, I suppose, you know, to steal from George W. Bush, this axis, this Iranian axis that just continues to use terror to destabilize That has to be gone, was essentially what this guy was saying. I felt this, what he was saying, for the Abraham Accords and for the normalisation to occur. And clearly that also has to mean Israel comes to that point too. And under Netanyahu, I don't think it's ever going to come to that point. But I have sympathy for both sides and their nervousness of each other, you know? Can you really imagine living alongside one another after this? Very easy to talk about, much harder to do. It's why I asked the question last week. Is this talk of a two-state solution a kind of pipe dream that we in the West have, a mantra almost that we in the West have to soothe ourselves about this horror? We're not the ones who are going to have to sit and live with it, are we? And the nervousness around it and the potential failure of it. With our neighbours, whichever neighbours you're talking about. More of your calls after the news headlines. Jenny Barsby has a news update.
An Israeli official says special forces are conducting operations inside Lebanon ahead of a potential ground assault. They're designed to gather intelligence and locate Hezbollah's positions. Four police officers and a member of staff are to face disciplinary proceedings over the David Carrick case. The watchdog's been looking into how the Metropolitan Police dealt with four allegations against the serial rapist while he was a serving officer. And a 96-year-old woman who killed a 76-year-old woman when her car mounted the pavement on Merseyside has been given a suspended sentence. June Mills was found guilty of causing the death by dangerous driving of Brenda Joyce in August last year. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales. Brighter elsewhere, highs of 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
The British Airways end of summer sale has landed. Just as you're about to return to the chaos of weekday mornings. First gear for miles down the motorway. Piles of paperwork, quick or nothing dinners, commutes with no personal space. You deserve another break. Find thousands of flights and holidays in the British Airways end of summer sale. Subject to availability. Sale ends 1st of October. Holidays are at all protected. Terms and conditions apply. Visit ba.com/sale.
As a nation, we're a generous lot. You could say giving is in our blood. And right now, we need all of you Giving Taps to give blood and help provide life-saving treatments. Blood is amazing. It can help combat cancer, ease emergencies, help fight sickle cell, and create life-saving medicines. So, please book an appointment and give blood now. We have lots of appointments available at convenient times, and our donor centres are based in the heart of cities. It takes an hour to save up to 3 lives. If you're the Giving Type, please book an appointment at blood.co.uk today.
Hello, you. High energy bills that keep changing can leave you feeling powerless. At Uswitch, our energy experts are working hard to bring you lower prices, exclusive deals, and more choice. Fix your deal now and take the power back. Uswitch. We put you first.
Okay, which is clearer? One or two?
Two.
Three or four?
Four.
Diabetes or high blood pressure?
Huh? Every eye tells a story, including giving us a clearer picture of your overall health. At Boots Opticians, our eye tests and advanced OCT eye scans can help spot over 10 health conditions, helping to open your eyes to a healthier future. Book an eye test today. Boots Opticians. See what's possible.
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Let's get to your calls on this question of escalation in the Middle East. Abdul has called from Ilford. Hello, Abdul.
Hi, Sheila. Yes, I think this is de-escalation. You see, what it is that this is for the public to listen to from America, US, UK. But the thing is, we're saying de-escalation, but you're giving them $9 billion worth of weaponry to attack. This is ridiculous. The hypocrisy is absolutely appalling. You know, on the one side, they're saying de-escalation, but you're arming them, so here's the weapons to carry on. It doesn't make sense.
But we have arms trade with all kinds of countries at any given time, including Israel, Abdul.
Yeah, but this is going to destabilize not only the Middle East, this is going to destabilize further beyond that. Even it's going to affect the global economy, because what's going to happen, the Houthis obviously controlling the Red Sea over there, and then you've got the Caspian Sea... Well, it's going to disrupt some trade at least, and then at the Caspian Sea where Iran has some control over, and the Arabian Peninsula as well. So what's going to happen? It's going to affect the whole world. So realistically, China, look at it this way. Look, the very inception of Israel. Look, I mean, even Hamas on 2014, they stated that we agreed to the 1967 two-state solution, which Ed Miliband also stated here, that we should have implemented the 1967 two-state solution, then we wouldn't have gone through all this, the continuous, you know, a cycle of violence that carries on. So the thing is, we should be descaling, we should be I mean, Israel is talking about the 1701 UN resolution. The thing is, pick and choose resolutions when you want to suit you, when you want to, you know, disregard it. That's where the problem lies. There's impunity for Israel, regardless of whatever they do. And we're talking about, you know, weapons behind.
Well, but that was aimed at Hezbollah, that resolution, wasn't it? And it's they who've disregarded it in this instance.
No, but my point is, when Israel wants to, when it suits Israel to bring up resolutions, they'll say, yes, this resolution, that resolution, we're doing this because of this. But when it doesn't suit their agenda, then they disregard everything. International law, international humanitarian law is completely disregarded. Everything is disregarded. So, you know, even before, there's not just 7th of October last year, Sheila. The thing is, we know there's a history, 2018, 2019, where the Great March of Return, where completely unarmed civilians were at the border fence, and they were just having, you could say, like a party, basically. And then there were snipers on the fence lined up, and they were shooting children, medics, people in wheelchairs, women, completely. You know, they took out so many people. So if we're looking at killing and then the reaction, look at that.
Can I ask you?
Yes.
I'm well aware this didn't begin in the 7th of October, but 7th of October was without a doubt a major escalation in the destabilization of the Middle East, wasn't it? Without a doubt. I mean, you don't have to take a side to say that. It just was. Can I ask you, what, in all of this, how you see Iran's role? Because, you know, you've made it clear what you think Israel should and shouldn't be doing. What about Iran and its use of organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah and its arming of them, for example?
I have not been a supporter of Iran, Hezbollah, and, you know, these organizations.
They're key players in the same problem.
No, but Sheila,
But do you accept that they are?
My point is, look,
don't give me another point. Answer my question. I'm prepared to accept that Israel is a key player in all of this and doesn't always get things right. Are you prepared to tell me that Iran is a key player in all of this, in its use of proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas, and doesn't always get things right? Are you prepared to say the same?
No, of course. Look, we can't justify every action of every organization, every state.
But in the solution, can you criticize them as well as Israel, is what I'm asking.
Of course. Look, everyone and every state.
Tell me something. You told me a lot about why you think Israel's getting stuff wrong. What's Iran getting wrong?
When I say Iran is getting wrong, in the sense that obviously they're using organizations and proxies to carry on,
terror attacks.
But the thing is, look, even 1982, when Hezbollah were created.
You're not prepared
listen.
I am listening. I'm listening really carefully to everything you say, and you're not prepared to do that.
You're
more pro-Iran, are you, than pro-Israel?
No, come on, Sheila.
No, are you? That's a question. I told you,
my first sentence, I'm not a supporter of Iran. I'm not a supporter of their proxies.
But do you see their role in all of this?
I'm a supporter of humanity, Sheila. Regardless of whether they're Israeli civilians or Palestinian civilians or civilians in the UK, wherever they are, I am a supporter of upholding humanity, Sheila. Mm. That's my point. My point is, whoever is killing innocents, they have no justification to do so, regardless of whether
they're all killing innocents, Abdul.
No, but my point is, look, the excuse.
But they all are.
The excuse that is used, that, you know, there's weapons in those buildings, so we're gonna flatten the whole building. That is not a justification to kill innocent people. Even if there's a weapon behind civilians, you can't kill the civilians just to get to the people you want to kill. It doesn't make sense.
It's happened in every war known to man.
No, Sheila.
Second World War, ourselves included in the Second World War, we flattened cities and killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in order to win the war.
we should be pushing for the two-state 1967 border solution as a long-term solution. In the interim, in the short term, we should be pushing Israel to get out of Lebanon, get out of Gaza. That's where it starts.
And what then should Iran do?
Iran won't do anything. Iran will move back.
No, what should Iran do? Israel, you've told me what you think Israel should do for this two-state solution to exist. What should Iran do? It's not going to be solved. This is not going to be solved by ignoring Iran, is it?
Basically, ignoring Iran, the thing is, there has to be a diplomatic solution, not a violent solution. There will never be a solution to continuous violence and cycle of violence. That will never be a solution. It will just carry on escalating further.
But it isn't just... I get that, Abdul. You know, we'd all like humanity to be left alone, to just be. But that isn't happening. And it isn't only Israel that's causing that not to happen, is it? It's in the current exchanges. It's not... It isn't... It isn't a one-sided war, is what I'm saying to you, Abdul. And you'd be forgiven for thinking so sometimes in some conversations. But thank you, Abdul, for your call in Ilford. Very conscious that central to what Abdul was saying, and I mentioned it myself a couple of times in the first half hour of the programme, is the horrible reality behind any of this political and diplomatic back and forth. Well, there isn't much diplomatic back and forth at the moment, is there? Is that horrible loss of civilian life. And I'm joined by Ahmed Behram, Middle East media advisor, at the Norwegian Refugee Council. Ahmed, thank you for joining me today. I guess, unlike Gaza, you have better access, do you, in Lebanon at this point?
Yes, very much so. We have teams on the ground in Lebanon. Of course, that has been affected in the last 2 weeks by the events in southern Lebanon, particularly where we had over 60 people supporting displaced populations who are now further displaced deeper into Lebanese territory. So we are now across Lebanon. We are seeing the horrifying consequences of this deadly conflict. And of course, on the people, on the displaced, on refugees, of course, that's a displacement crisis within a refugee crisis in Lebanon, on top of an economic crisis. So we are worried, and we are, of course, horrified by the death toll amongst civilians, of course, and particularly those who are left without home, without a farm, without a job.
And even before these events of the last couple of weeks, and before the events of the last year, say, what kind of state was Lebanon in? Because for a start, I know from my own experience reporting years back, it has taken in a lot of Syrian refugees, hasn't it? And that has put a great deal of pressure on its economy, on its society. But it had problems even before then, didn't it, in terms of governance and getting itself back on its own feet?
Absolutely, it did. And I lived there through the worst years, I have to say, probably 2019 to 2022, which were the worst 2 or 3 years of probably Lebanon's modern history in terms of economic crisis. It was a normal scene to see people lining up in long queues, waiting for a tank of petrol or a bag of bread or any basic necessity, really. And now things will, of course, deteriorate with, for example, healthcare system being squeezed even further, medication running out fast. And of course, despite the reassurances that we get from there, we do expect, you know, the economic aspect to be, to be crippled quite massively. So Lebanon has never recovered really since COVID times. It had a crisis thrown on top of another crisis, and of course on top of a refugee dilemma that has been, you know, that has grappled.
And who could forget that dreadful explosion at the port as well?
Yeah, on top of all of that, and probably the worst inflation rates that we have in modern history as well. The price hikes were just exuberant at the time, and. They remain so. So Lebanon doesn't really cannot afford another, you know, war on its doorstep, and it is very much unfolding at the moment.
And is it easier to help the Lebanese who are injured than it is to help the Gazans who are injured? Presumably, there's a more functioning hospital system. All of the above.
You're right to draw similarities, and I can tell you probably Lebanon, if it continues this way, it's not going to be far off from facing a huge, huge human catastrophe, particularly that, you know, we are talking about injury rates that are quite high, actually. You are talking about thousands of injuries that, you know, the entire health system has to deal with. And we have seen reports of some. Now it's actually a choice between, you know, which life-threatening situation you have to deal with, and whether you have to, you know, evacuate or release patients who could wait in their homes. So it is different, but it is similar. We don't want to get there, really. We don't want
to, of course,
imagine a nightmare scenario where, you know, what we have seen in Gaza repeats in Lebanon. But I think all attention has to be on, and all efforts have to be exerted now to pull us really back from the brink. The entire region is boiling, and the people cannot take another conflict in this in this region.
I'm very conscious that when, you know, when I have conversations on air, either with politicians or commentators or my callers, you know, who have a view one way or another, the reality on the ground for the people that you're helping is they're just trying to stay alive. I saw a story this morning of a mum and dad and a couple of kids, not knowing whether to go into a building doorway for shelter when the bombing started or stay outside for safety. So they chose kind of halfway, and one of their children was still very severely injured and is in hospital. So these awful moment-to-moment life and death decisions having to be made.
On a daily basis, an hourly basis, I mean, you've given an example, and this is what we see, you know, around the clock. Really, people who, for example, in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, who fled those areas 20 kilometers close to the border, from the border, they went deep into Beirut. And even in Beirut, they found that they were not safe. I mean, the areas that are being hit, for example, in Beirut, these are the most congested of all places in Lebanon. If you look, if you walk down these streets, you see how narrow the alleys are and how close homes are from each other. So, you know, the impact is actually manifold what we see in areas, in towns and villages where, you know, you have some space and you have some homes that are a bit detached from each other. Mm. Here it's a different story, of course. These are, you know, over densely populated areas, impoverished areas, and people who leave there will have nowhere to go besides probably, you know, have to spend some time at a bus station or outside a mosque or a church. So, yes, this is why we are looking at, you know, numbers are, you know, in terms of displacement are through the roof
and
already.
Is it possible to say yet, you know, you're obviously still getting a picture, I guess, of what's going on, but those many, many thousands, up to a million people displaced, how far displaced are they, if you see what I mean? Do they tend to go just to slightly more open areas near to where they live, or are they really leaving and getting the hell out?
It varies. I mean, in Beirut, they have to probably leave, I don't know, stay a few kilometers away, I would say 5 to 6 kilometers, and probably watch from the horizon as you know, smoke billows from the areas that they are from, and have to watch their phones and see which area, which exact street, which exact building was hit. Some areas in northern Bekaa, for example, by closer from the border to Syria, have traveled tens of kilometers down the road to central Bekaa, which is not that safe either. And probably the most atrocious of all these trips are those, you know, people who left all the way from the southern border to Syria. And that is hundreds of kilometers they had to do overnight. And, you know, because they could not afford rent in Lebanon, for example, and had no safety. And amongst those, you know, 2/3 of the 100,000 that we are talking about who fled to Syria are actually Syrians who themselves have been refugees. It's, I could tell you, I mean, the situation is particularly bad for these people, and particularly for those who are left with nothing and who have left with nothing. And now, you know, the death toll amongst the civilians continues to rise. They are, yes.
Ahmed, thank you. I hope to speak to you again. Ahmed Behram, Middle East Media Advisor at the Norwegian Refugee Council. Your call's in a moment. It's 1:47.
LBC This Morning on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Kemi Badenoch sparking a furious row yesterday for suggesting that statutory maternity pay is excessive. Lisa's in Rochester. Is that right? You're on maternity leave now, Lisa?
Yes, yes,
well, congratulations. How long ago did you have the baby?
Just under 4 months. He's 4 months tomorrow. So I think the point that people tend to kind of forget when they're talking about maternity pay and mums kind of getting caught 3 months is we're literally creating the workforce that's going to be working in the next 20 to 30 years. So mums may now make a decision that, look, like, I can't afford to go on maternity pay or go on maternity leave. I can't afford to have children, which I think a lot of people are doing.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7.
With Betfair, where odds move faster than polls. Play responsibly.
LBC.
I'm very proud to launch my new M&S Food and Tom Kerridge Gastropub range. It's taken years of hard work to bring the flavours of my restaurants to the shelves of M&S. So choose a main, side, and either a starter or a dessert in the Gastropub dine-in. For your dessert, give my super indulgent molten cookie dough a go, oozing with dark and white Belgian chocolate with a touch of sea salt. This is not just food. This is Tom Kerridge and M&S Gastropub food. Subject to availability, T's and C's apply.
With the biggest range of cars to buy entirely online, it's no wonder everyone's cinching it.
I cinched it during spin class. Think I'm going to be sick.
I cinched it in this coffee shop.
What are you having?
A five-door hatchback.
This is your captain speaking. I cinched it before takeoff with a 14-day money-back guarantee.
With so many great reasons to buy, the nation aren't just nailing it, they're cinching it. Comparison against equivalent retailers. Visit cinch.co.uk/range claim. Mileage restrictions and terms apply.
Making mochi at a homestay in Japan. Finding the best banh mi in Hanoi with the help of a local. Camping with wildlife rangers in South Africa. The best parts of travel happen when you find yourself in that place, at that moment, with those people. And a small group tour with Intrepid Travel will bring you plenty of those moments. For thousands of experiences in over 100 countries, visit intrepidtravel.com. Only Intrepid.
We've all been there. MOT's coming up, your car's making a noise or two. And you think if you just turn your music up just a little louder each time, you'll be fine. But that's not you, is it? You know you can get your car in check with parts that will fit right. All you need to do is enter your reg on eBay. Find brake lights, filters, windscreen wipers and more and get your car MOT ready. Find the right part at the right price with eBay.
Did you know you could get the winter fuel payment or the equivalent in Scotland if you get pension credit? Pension credit is worth on average £3,900 per year and gives you help with other living costs. It's for people aged 66 or over and on a low income. Check the online eligibility calculator today to see if you're entitled. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. Eligibility criteria apply.
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Damon has called from Hemel Hempstead to carry on our conversation around Israel and escalation or de-escalation, which is what the UK has been calling for. Damon, hi.
Sheila, good afternoon. I originally thought to say probably exactly the same thing that Nick was saying before his phone cut off. So I'm happy to move.
You finish his conversation then.
Well, you're just about to ask him a question. But I really want to bring it down to the fundamental issue of what's changed in the Middle East. If you go back, Beirut used to be the Paris of the Middle East. Iran and Persia under the Shah was a beautiful country anybody could visit. But it's the takeover of Iran by fundamental Islam that is at war against every other religion. And it comes down to a simple medieval religious war that they're carrying out, obviously in the Middle East against the Jews, but in Africa against the Christians. All over the world.
There is Islamofascists, basically.
Islamofascism. And that's exactly what the Iranian regime is. Mm-hmm. And that's what their proxies at Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis follow exactly the same ideology. Mm. They want the Jews dead in Israel. They want the Christians dead in Africa. And it's, you know, it's something that the West has ignored. And shame on the West. Shame on America. Shame on.
Has the West ignored it, or has it failed to really understand it in the way that we've failed to understand Hitler, didn't we, for a long time?
The West has subsidized it, Sheila. What Barack Obama gave $6 billion to the Iranian regime
in the nuclear deal.
In the nuclear deal.
I'm not going to take a view on that because I don't know enough about it, but he and those who support that would have argued, I mean, there were plenty of voices against it in this country, weren't there, would have argued that that was a deeply pragmatic geopolitical move about nuclear safety. Don't put nuclear...
Look where it's led.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And, you know, you don't have to be a genius, and Barack Obama is certainly no genius for doing that. You don't have to be a genius to say, if you fund Islamo-fascists, they're going to become stronger. They're going to want to take over. They want their proxies in Lebanon and their proxies in Yemen and their proxies all over the world to do their dirty work for them. And they'll fund them with the $6 billion that Barack Obama gave them.
So our position should have always been what? Absolute zero engagement, zero tolerance.
We should have done to the Ayatollah what we did to other regimes in the area. They were more important to do it to the Ayatollah than it was to do it to Saddam Hussein.
But that didn't lead to glory, did it, for anybody?
It did, no.
Or indeed safety, Damon, if that's what our bottom line is here.
But the fact is that, you know, if you can't pick and choose which fascist leader you're going to take out. Why support one and destroy another? And what are we going to do now? We don't know what the problem is. Everybody knows what the problem is.
Well, go on, okay? You tell me what you think it is.
The problem is Iran and their Islamo-fascist ideology want to take over the world. They want a caliphate. They're no different to Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of those mad mobs. They're exactly the same.
I worry about, you know, this whole year has been a learning curve for me as well. There's so much to know and learn and find out about, isn't there, you know, on this? And anyone, apart from actual experts who claim to know it all, are wrong, you know, or are kidding themselves. But I think the scale of ignorance on the street, the so-called street about it in this country, in other Western countries, is dangerous. It's dangerous. Those who would cry about the death of Nasrallah because Netanyahu has killed him probably don't know any. I didn't know the depth to which he was involved in the Syrian war. I didn't know that until this weekend. You know, there's a lot of stuff we don't know, and we view it with naive Western eyes, probably quite a lot.
There's lots of naive Western eyes. I mean, at the end of the day, Israel is a Middle Eastern country, and it sits with its Middle Eastern neighbours with a view on the world that's very different to the Western one. And we view Israel as a Western country. Yes, it's a democracy. Yes, it supports a lot of our Western values, but it is a Middle Eastern country. And when I go there as a Jew, I appreciate the differences.
It's its own thing.
But the fact that there are people who will be having a go at the killing of a massive terrorist, the leader of the terrorist organization, and there's two types of people that will do that. One are the supporters of Islamo-fascism in the UK, and there are plenty of them. Mm-hmm. And the other is one I really can't get my head around. It's the far left, and how the far left are in bed with the fascists, I have no idea. I don't know why they support, why they stand together, why the socialist workers support every march against Israel. It's just crazy. The people on the left who...
We do know, don't we? It's an anti-American worldview, and it's anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Propping up all of that.
Yeah. And that's what the far left is, and that's why we were celebrating. We had parties on the defeat of Corbyn. With a group of people, and we hopefully all played our little part in that defeat. But we had parties when Corbyn was defeated because he's an anti-Semite. I can say it. I know you can't. we have to defend ourselves. We have to defend ourselves in this country, in America, across the world, but especially in Israel. And that's what they're doing. And that's what, you know, I'm not a massive supporter. I'm not a Likud supporter. I'm not a massive supporter of Netanyahu. But at the moment, Netanyahu is doing the right thing to save Jewish lives.
Okay. Thanks, Damon. Damon and Hemel. Alex has called from Ealing. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Hello, Sheila. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Yes, you lived in Israel for many years.
I lived in Israel for many years. Excuse me, I have a frog in my throat today.
Okay.
I lived in Israel for many years, and I saw the rise of people like Netanyahu and the settlers. I want to make this a nuanced call because I have something to say on both sides. I was very dismayed to see the beginning of the building of the settlements, and I thought this was a very bad move for Israel. And
in the West Bank?
In
the West Bank?
Yes, and I still think it was, and I think it's done huge damage. Mm. However, you're right, there is a tremendous lack of knowledge about Israel, and I understand that. I don't expect people here to understand.
Not just about Israel, about all of it, you know. About
all of
the
it.
Region,
you know, Middle
yeah.
East politics, very complicated, and sometimes I've said to people, do you know that the Palestine has never yet been a country with its own national integrity? Because first of all, there was the Ottoman Empire, and then there was the British, and people are astonished, and they say, oh, I thought it was a nation, and Israel took away the nation. No, Israel was created. And that brings me to another point, which is this. In 1948, the UN voted that there should be a country, the country of Israel. And Israel has not had one single day since then without being attacked. And what's really driven me mad the last few days with Lebanon, and believe me, I feel so, so sad about civilians being killed. It's unbearable. But what has driven me mad is they talk about Israel having been bombarded by Hezbollah either since last October or over the last 8 or 9 years. I was in Israel in 1982. I got married in 1982.
And it was being bombed even then. Alex, I'm so sorry. I have to leave it there, and I know you wanted more time. We will return to this subject, and do call again. Thank you, Alex, calling from Ealing. Coming up after the news at 2, I want to return to something Kemi Badenoch said over the weekend about valid cultures.
On your radio, on Global Player, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 2 o'clock, the UK's reiterated the need for a ceasefire in Lebanon as fears grow of an Israeli ground offensive against Hezbollah. The group's deputy leaders insisted they're ready for any invasion. And Sam Kiley, former foreign affairs editor at Sky News, has told LBC they are a powerful organisation.
Hezbollah is a state within a state in Lebanon. It can mobilise, it claims, 150,000 people. It sent 40,000 people to fight for Assad. It is also part of an international criminal mafia network of drug smuggling and money laundering.
The UK government has again urged all British nationals to get out of Lebanon on the next available flight. Four police officers and a staff member are to face disciplinary proceedings over the David Carrick case. The former Met officer was jailed for a minimum of 30 years for 49 violent and sexual offences, including 24 counts of rape. Fraser Knight reports for LBC.
A watchdog's been looking at the missed opportunities to sack the serial rapist from the police before he was arrested, with multiple complaints being made against him by former partners. Four police officers and a staff member will now be disciplined for claims they failed to follow up on them properly.
After more than 100 years, traditional steel making in South Wales will come to an end later. The last furnace at Tata Steel in Port Talbot shuts this evening with the loss of thousands of jobs. It's being replaced with an electric version, but that won't be up and running until 2028. Nia Griffith is a minister in the Wales office and told LBC it was handled very badly.
There could have been a more gradual transition, and we would have been very much up for that. The problem is we came in at very, very last minute when the Conservative government had just been doing nothing, not just for the last 10 months.